Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 27, 2003. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The United Nations Security Council unanimously adopts a resolution late yesterday making it clear that deliberate attacks against humanitarian workers are war crimes. Workers at Yale University strike for better retirement pay. And still no word from the White House in answer to charges from within the EPA that the administration ordered the agency to lie about the air quality in Lower Manhattan after September 11. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A court in northern Nigeria started hearing the second appeal of a woman sentenced to death by stoning. Semola Koya reports from Lagos.
Amina Lawal was sentenced to death by stoning by an Islamic court that found her guilty of committing adultery. Death by stoning is the prescribed punishment for this offense under the Islamic law being practiced in northern Nigeria. She lost an earlier appeal against the death sentence, and now she has appeared in court for yet another crucial legal battle to stay alive. Her lawyers are appealing the death sentence on 12 grounds. This happened well before Islamic law was introduced in her home state of Katsina. The plight of the condemned woman has caused outrage around the world, especially amongst women's activists who said she suffered discrimination during her trial. While the man accused of committing adultery with her was set free after proclaiming his innocence by taking an oath with the Islamic holy book, the Quran, Amina Lawal was not given such an opportunity. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
California Governor Gray Davis today signs a bill to protect consumers' financial privacy. Consumer advocates worry a bill in the U.S. Congress, supported by the Bush administration, will preempt any state law that ensures such privacy. Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, D.C.
Concerning junk mail, do you ever wonder how credit card companies got your name and address? Well, financial institutions like banks sell and share consumer personal information amongst themselves. Such information includes bank deposits and purchases, allowing companies to create consumer profiles. Such information is not always used for benign purposes. Former employees from a Citigroup affiliate admitted pushing unneeded insurance policies onto immigrants. California is about to enact the first broad financial privacy law, but Jamie Court, with the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights, says a bill in Congress supported by the Bush administration will render a law like California's useless.
President Bush had some very strong things to say about privacy on the campaign trail. He said that I think that consumers should have absolute control over their private financial information. He said that I think that Social Security number sales should be criminalized, and yet he hasn't delivered on any of these pledges, and he's poised to overturn laws in states like California. He's got to be embarrassed, and he's got to be stopped.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Washington.
India criticized the World Trade Organization for not accommodating the concerns of developing countries regarding the reduction of agricultural subsidies. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
India's Commerce and Industry Minister has said India will not agree to cut tariffs on imported agriculture products. Arun Jaitley says that eliminating tariffs in India, while other countries still protect their farm sectors with large subsidies, would be forcing its resources to poor farmers to compete with subsidized rich farmers. That, he says, would push India to destitution. India has made it clear that such a policy would only be adopted if developed nations eliminate their own huge farm subsidies so that poor Indian farmers do not compete with subsidized and rich farmers in the West. The WTO is already divided on the matter, and any agreement at Cancun will be crucial to multilateral trade and agrarian economy like India. So far, the US and the European Union have refused to eliminate these high farm subsidies. Close to 650 million people in India depend on agriculture, and any adverse agreement on this issue will have major repercussions socially, economically, and most important, politically. From India, Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
The Texas 11 cancel plans to return to their state today. Lawmakers say they're wary of a plot to arrest them. Renee Feltz reports.
This morning, 7 of the 11 Democratic state lawmakers canceled plans to cross the New Mexico-Texas border after they obtained credible evidence that Republican Governor Rick Perry intended to call a third special session and send deputized officials to detain them. Yesterday marked the end of a second special legislative session, allowing the Texas 11 to return to the state. They were scheduled to attend a hearing today in Laredo, where they filed a suit alleging Republicans would harm minority voting rights with their decision to drop a Senate tradition requiring two-thirds of the Senate to debate a bill. This afternoon, the judge declined to rule, passing the decision to a judicial panel. The judge supported a Democratic proposal that legislators be given 72 hours notice before Governor Perry calls for a third special session. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution late yesterday making it clear that deliberate attacks against humanitarian workers are war crimes. The measure passed after a reference to the International Criminal Court, which Washington strongly opposes, was dropped from the text. The move comes as the UN and international aid agencies are reassessing their presence in Iraq following last week's truck bombing of UN headquarters in Baghdad, which killed 23 people and injured dozens more. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The resolution, sponsored by Mexico and five other Security Council members, calls on states to prosecute anyone attacking UN and other humanitarian workers. It was tabled last spring, but languished because the United States opposed a reference to the definition of war crimes contained in the statute of the International Criminal Court. Following last week's suicide bombing, however, which the Council characterized as a terrorist attack, the U.S. signaled it would drop its objections if the ICC reference was deleted. Mexican Ambassador Adolfo Aguilar Zinser told reporters afterwards that a tough choice was made to achieve consensus.
This resolution has an extraordinary meaning as far as the United Nations Security Council is united behind the actions that are proposed and the responsibilities that are assumed. And the message to the international community and to the perpetrators of attacks against humanitarian workers could not be as firm as if the resolution is not adopted unanimously.
Human rights groups welcomed the resolution, saying it offered greater protection to aid workers in conflict zones. But a resolution is unlikely to change what relief agencies encounter on the ground. The International Committee of the Red Cross and Oxfam International have already reduced their foreign staff in Iraq, and U.S.-based agencies, which are funded by the U.S. government, are reviewing their options. The U.N., too, is pulling back. There, the notion that the world body could be the target of a terrorist attack, despite its neutral stance, remains incomprehensible. But according to Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University, it shouldn't be.
It seems to me, and one says this with a lot of sympathy for the victims and the innocent lives that were lost, that it shouldn't be surprising because the Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has succeeded in the last few years in turning the United Nations into a mere tool of U.S. foreign policy.
Abu Khalil says Annan maintains a double standard on the Middle East, condemning Palestinian attacks against Israeli civilians, but refusing to condemn the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan and Iraq, in which, he says, a far higher number of civilians have died. Dennis Halliday, former UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq, says Iraqis associate the UN with the 13-year sanctions regime imposed by the Security Council that deprived them of food and medicine.
Probably a million Iraqis have lost their lives in these 13 years, mainly children perhaps. There's not an Iraqi family that hasn't had a loss, I would say, or in the larger sense of a larger extended family loss. We have to remember that. So there's no love for the United Nations in the Middle East and certainly not in Iraq.
Ironically, it was Annan's special representative in Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello, killed in last week's attack, who in a prescient speech in July recognized the contradiction inherent in the UN's presence in the country under a U.S.-led occupation.
The United Nations' presence in Iraq remains vulnerable to any who would seek to target our organization. Our security continues to rely significantly on the reputation of the United Nations, our ability to demonstrate meaningfully that we are in Iraq to assist its people and our independence.
Prompted by both political and security concerns, some are calling on the UN to leave Iraq, including UN staff members, who held silent protest marches in several countries on Tuesday. Dennis Halliday disagrees. He notes that the Oil for Food program, on which 60% of Iraqis depended for sustenance before the invasion, is due to expire in November, and says UN workers can help ensure a smooth transition.
The UN has got to take a different stance, transfer the oil for food capacity back to Iraq where it has always been, get the Americans out of the country and start then responding to the needs of the country as determined and as requested by the Iraqis who take over this country when it becomes a sovereign state once again.
After meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell last week, Annan seemed prepared to endorse the concept of a multinational peacekeeping force authorized by the Security Council that would operate under U.S. command in Iraq. Such a move, says Halliday, would be a tragic mistake that would further diminish the UN's credibility. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Two explosions in quick succession in Mumbai or Bombay, India, on Monday this week killed 52 civilians. Yesterday, President Bush called the Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee and offered his assistance in combating terrorism. While the UN, the United States, Russia and England promptly condemned the blast as an act of terror, back in India, the Hindu right and other political parties have been trying to gain political mileage from the incident for upcoming elections. From New Delhi, our correspondent Vinod K. Jose asks why the politicians jumped to conclusions when the investigating agency so far have no leads.
Indian police officials have yet to point to suspects in the twin bombings Monday in Bombay, but that has not stopped politicians from capitalizing on the attacks. After the visit at the blast site yesterday, the Hindu right leader and the deputy prime minister of the country, L.K. Advani, blamed it on the Pakistan-based armed group Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Students' Islamic Movement of India.
Their target is not just Kashmir, nor Punjab, nor just Delhi. Their target is the whole of India. Terrorism is going to destabilize the whole country.
But after 2 days, the investigative agencies have failed to prove the theories of the Hindu right political leaders. And now, there does not seem to be too many takers for the theories of the Hindu right government. Professor Bhim Singh, the chairman of Jammu and Kashmir Panthers Party, told this to Free Speech Radio News immediately after the blast.
You know, today in Bombay, several dozen people are killed. How it happened, why it happened, doesn't convince anybody. There are many hidden facts in this story.
This was a Hindu right leader addressing a rally of its supporters at a central Indian town yesterday. With the state elections and general election coming in another few months, the Hindu right considers incidents like Bombay blast powerful ammunition to revive its supporters at the grassroots. Dr. Kamal Mitra Chennai, a senior left intellectual, thinks the ruling Hindu right, Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP, is making the maximum political mileage out of the bomb blast.
With the general elections coming next year, these people have a vested political interest in whipping up fears of terror, in exaggerating the role of Pakistan, in mentioning the role of Pakistan in terrorism throughout the country. So that's a lot of what is said about terror in India has to do with domestic politics, even if it is claimed that international politics is involved.
In the domestic politics calendar, a court verdict is going to be very crucial in the coming months. None other than the Deputy Prime Minister of the country is facing the trial for masterminding a Hindu right movement to demolish a mosque in Ayodhya 12 years ago. It is generally accepted that the nationwide campaign to build the Rama temple and the destruction of the mosque was responsible for the Hindu right's rapid rise to power. On the day of the Bombay blast, Archaeological Survey of India released a report saying they found evidence of a construction when they excavated the site of the mosque. Many historians criticize this theory of Muslim invaders demolishing a Hindu temple and constructing a mosque over it in the medieval period. Syed Shihabuddin of the Babri Mosque Action Committee.
The report by itself is neither conclusive nor very definite. It only adds to the vagueness of the situation.
The progressive intellectuals of the country think political actions like bomb blast, sectarian violence, mosque demolition, etc. are used as good tools for the Hindu right ideology to flourish. Again, Dr. Chennai.
These people have a particular ideology they want to spread as an electoral tool to help them win power, and that is Hindutva. I think it is a neo-fascist ideology.
Amidst the blame game, rallies like these are taking place all over the country to drum up support for the Hindu right government in the upcoming elections. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Still no word from the White House in answer to charges from within the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, that the administration ordered the agency to lie about the air quality in Lower Manhattan after September 11. Democrat New York lawmakers are asking for a full investigation. Josh Chaffin spoke to people who work near the World Trade Center site today and brings us the final part of our series investigating the Environmental Protection Agency.
In recent days, even the most middle-of-the-road New York City newspapers have editorialized against the White House. They're reacting to a report from the Inspector General of the Environmental Protection Agency, which alleges the administration told the EPA not to give New Yorkers the whole truth about the air quality after the September 11th attack. Thousands of recovery workers and Lower Manhattan residents have been diagnosed with respiratory illnesses allegedly contracted from the asbestos and lead and glass and concrete dust in the air around the World Trade Center site.
I don't think it's that bad.
This morning, some of the workers who were near the site at the time of the attacks chalked the latest allegations up to pre-election political maneuvering.
But, you know, who knows? You know, they're making pretty strong claims that, you know, the White House knew.
My name is Carr, Ansel Carr. I'm not really hungry. Got to do something as far as the economy is concerned. That's why they make that statement by the year was good.
But you're not worried about people's health down here?
I do. I worry about my health, too. I work in it.
At a City Hall press conference yesterday, Democrat New York Senator Hillary Clinton asked for congressional hearings and for a Justice Department investigation into the matter.
I know a little bit about how White Houses work. I know somebody picked up a phone, somebody got on a computer, somebody sent an email, somebody called for a meeting, somebody in that White House, probably under instructions from somebody further up the chain, told the EPA, don't tell the people of New York the truth.
Clinton says she wants to know who in the White House gave the order. Early press reports point to Bush's chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, James Conatton, who before his appointment in 2001 worked as a lawyer for some of the most polluting corporations in the world, including General Electric. One of his clients, Sarco, has more than 1,000 asbestos liability suits against it. Eric Goldstein, director of the New York Urban Division of the Natural Resources Defense Council, says that's a problem. Goldstein's been warning for more than a year that the EPA gave the all clear too soon.
From everything we've read in the press, it seems as if the White House is simply hoping that this issue goes away. That's a very serious charge the Inspector General has leveled, and it raises some serious concerns about the trustworthiness of the White House in responding to environmental crises.
The White House has been mum on the issue of the EPA Inspector General's allegations, but the acting administrator of the EPA, Marianne Horinko, takes issue with her own Inspector General's report. Horinko told the papers, "No one at the White House said to us, tone down what you're saying." Taking a smoke break in front of his office across the street from the World Trade Center crater, a manager, who didn't want his name used, said the air quality controversy is just another recent episode that undermines his faith in the government.
I put absolute credibility in the concept that they covered up. And his behavior is consistent with the war in Iraq.
How do you mean?
Well, to the extent that I think that they overstated the threat.
Christy Todd Whitman, the EPA administrator at the time of the September attacks, resigned earlier this summer, and she's been unavailable for comment since the IG report came out last week. The White House has yet to deliver a definitive statement in response to the allegations. Josh Chaffin on Wall Street for Free Speech Radio News.
The United States still won't promise not to attack North Korea. That's the position of the American negotiating team that started 3 days of six-country talks in Beijing today on what the Bush administration has dubbed the North Korean nuclear crisis. In response to the U.S. position, Russia's chief negotiator told reporters today that North Korea will not abandon nuclear weapons until the Bush administration promises in writing that it will not attack. Despite that, China's government expressed optimism about the talks. From Seoul, Yongji Kang has more on the Chinese role.
Speaking after the conclusion of the first day of talks in Beijing, China's foreign minister said he was very excited about the talks and that every country had agreed on the two principles of peace and a denuclearized Korean peninsula. China sees itself as the only country that can bring America and North Korea to the table together. This is the second round of talks organized by Beijing. The first were three-way talks in April. But South Korean political analyst Yang Dong-ju says that China doesn't have the real influence on North Korea because China hasn't helped the country in almost 50 years. For example, he notes that China donated just one-sixth of the amount of rice America did while North Korea was suffering from its worst famine in late
1990s.
China should really help North Korea to go forward by opening and reforming its economy and actually give economic support. I mean, China should change its own strategy towards North Korea to really support North Korea practically. If China continues to neglect North Korea or only use North Korea as a card, it would be harmful to China in the long term. With the present strategy, China would have little influence on North Korea. Then even China can't keep its own long-term interests.
At the heart of China's interest is the country's fear of losing its power in Asia. Dongdaek Women's University professor Kim Chang-woo says that as South Korea, Japan, and the United States have built a close alliance, China feels pushed into a corner. Every American movement or strategy in Asia seems to be an aggressive action toward China.
During the Cold War, there was a kind of barrier that enclosed China as an arrow. Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, Southeast Asia. Also, there are other USA defense barriers against China. That is, the USA bases in the Pacific Ocean and Guam. China believes that America encloses China with a double barrier. Also, these days, USA troops are stationed in the Middle East and Central Asia. China feels all of these oppressing China. So these days, though China is talking about the friendship and strategic partnership with the West for peace, China still understands the West is the very opposite side of China.
In addition to deploying more American troops in Asia, the USA is trying to develop a missile defense system called the Theater Missile Defense, or TMD. The Bush administration says the TMD would defend America from so-called rogue states like North Korea. China believes it is the ultimate target of the TMD. But Jung-wook Shik of the Peace Korea Network says there would be too much risk if America said that openly, which is why the Bush administration continues to exaggerate North Korean threat and hasn't really tried to solve the country's threat problem.
The contradiction of the U.S. is that the country always talks about the North Korean nuclear threat to the world, and there is certainly a way to solve this threat through peaceful and diplomatic ways. The U.S. doesn't choose that way. Why? Why does the Bush administration criticize the North Korean nuclear issue so harshly and doesn't try at all to solve it with peaceful and diplomatic means? What the Bush administration is most afraid of is that there is no threat in the Asian region that they can use as a good excuse to develop TMD. If not, I want to ask the U.S. to explain to me what is the reason.
Talks continue in Beijing tomorrow and Friday, but few expect results from this week's meetings. Many say it is the beginning of a long process, though many South Koreans are afraid of this process will go on without any result for too long. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang in Seoul.
Workers at Yale University went on strike early this morning. Thousands rallied outside Yale's investment office in support of several retired workers who occupied the office yesterday and vowed to remain until they get better retirement pay. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
Jesse Jackson made one of his many visits to New Haven to support Yale workers. He said the protesting retirees represent the cutting edge of the movement for workers' rights and respect. Referring to their efforts and to tomorrow's 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington, which was officially called the March for Jobs and Freedom, he told the crowd,
"In many ways, Yale was founded on slavery. It must be saved by bravery."
Some retirees with 25 to 30 years of service are getting Yale pensions of $600 a month. They point out that recently Yale's Board of Trustees increased President Rick Levin's pension to $29,000 a month. Due to extremely successful investing, Yale has an endowment of $10.5 billion and a $200 million surplus in its pension fund. Chief Union Negotiator Michael Boyle.
Instead of sharing that investment gain, they essentially want to keep it so that they won't have to make any contributions into the future. They haven't made any contributions, zero, for the last 4 years.
The Yale unions are represented by Locals 34 and 35 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. HERE's president, John Wilhelm, got his start in the labor movement at Yale, and he came back to try to help the unions reach a contract settlement. New Haven Mayor John DeStefano put pressure on Yale President Rick Levin to attend a last-minute bargaining session yesterday, but the two sides remained far apart. Community leaders and city officials, including DeStefano, have spoken out strongly in favor of the workers' struggle. At a rally on Monday, the mayor told union members,
"What happens in this campus, at this campus, matters to the rest of the city. And it matters, because you can't talk about New Haven and not understand what Yale and New Haven means, and where we're going as a community, and what we're going to be, and what we are. And so your struggle is whose struggle? It's the whole city's struggle."
Today's warm, sunny weather was a far cry from the weather during the union's one-week strike back in March. As picketers gathered in small groups all over town, many struck up friendly conversation with the police who were stationed to route traffic around the strikers. One union member said she went on strike for 10 weeks in 1984 in the successful effort to organize Yale's clerical and technical workers, and she was prepared to do it again.
My name is Mo Dagleri, and I am a dock worker. I've been there 21 years. Our pension is terrible. Nationally, wage increase is always a factor, but job security and retirement are the main issues.
Other workers on strike are the 150 dietary workers at Yale New Haven Hospital, who are members of Local 1199. They've also been working without a contract and have lower pay and fewer benefits than Yale's unions. They say in addition to a better contract, their goal is to get the rest of the hospital's 1,800 patient care workers organized. They had a message for Yale as they chanted on the sidewalk beside a busy intersection near the hospital.
Get up off of that loop. Get up off of that loop.
Yale is New Haven's biggest employer. A university spokesman says the fact that so many workers retire from Yale shows it can compete to attract and keep good employees. It offers many benefits that even the unions agree are generous, including fully paid medical coverage for workers and their families, several weeks of vacation, and at least $20,000 toward buying a home in New Haven. The spokesman says even the pensions are generous and that Yale has increased payments voluntarily over the years. But the unions say the wages are below what workers make at other area universities, universities that don't have Yale's extremely deep pockets. No one is predicting how long the strike will last, but with 10 strikes at Yale since 1965, the workers, the administration, the students, and the citizens of New Haven are all used to the drill. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Cutter Mesta, Simba Russo, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Our technical production team is Jade Pageant-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. We also have technical assistance from our intern, Bob Stern. I'm Deepa Fernandez.